Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this hour is Steve Call. In 2005, Call won the Pulitzer Prize for his book, Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden, from the Soviet invasion to September 10, 2001. That book examined in detail the actions of the CIA in Afghanistan from the time of the Soviet invasion to the aftermath of attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Call's latest book picks up where that account left off. It's titled Directorate S, The CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. The account offers a 15-year narrative, which opens on the eve of September 11th and takes us up to pretty much the present. Publishers Weekly calls Directorate S perhaps the most comprehensive work to date on the U.S. war in Afghanistan. Steve Call joins me now. He's also Dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University, former president of the New America Foundation, and staff writer for The New Yorker. Steve Call, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about the Inter-Services Intelligence Agency, or ISI, before we get to the title of your book, Directorate S. It's Pakistan's version of the CIA, the major focus of your book. Tell us about ISI's origins to begin with.
Well, it's part of the Pakistan military, which has ruled the country for many years since it gained independence in 1947. But it really came of age, ISI did, during the 1980s when the CIA worked with ISI as well as Saudi intelligence to run guns and money to the Afghan Mujahideen who were fighting the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. And with this infusion of hundreds of millions of dollars of support, ISI not only helped these guerrillas kick out the Soviet troops, ISI itself grew into a kind of state within the Pakistani state, a really powerful agency that not only influenced these Islamist groups fighting across the borders, but also manipulated domestic politics and became a kind of secret police force in a soft way, but still very powerful inside Pakistan. And so on 9/11, when we prepared to attack al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, ISI was the main backer of the Taliban, which then ruled Afghanistan and kind of accommodated al-Qaeda. So we essentially went to the Pakistan military chief, at that time Pervez Musharraf, and famously said, you know, you're either with us or against us. And Pakistan decided to switch sides, to abandon the Taliban, to fight with us, but gradually they went back to the playbook that they had used in the 1980s and started to support the Taliban again.
Within the ISI, the Pakistan's spy agency, intelligence agency, there is Directorate S. What is that then?
So that's the covert action arm, the group that maintains these secret ties and communications with the Taliban, with Taliban factions like the Haqqani network that's responsible for so much violence in Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan. And it also works with groups that menace India in the other direction in Kashmir. But it's made up of, it's sort of like the paramilitary division of the CIA or some sections of the National Clandestine Service of the CIA. It's a group of often ex-special forces, Pakistani ex-special forces that maintain these contacts with the Taliban and like groups.
Okay, you talked about the beginning of the war. Let's go back there. This is a 15-year account, a narrative that you give in this new book, Directorate S, the CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Let's go back to a few moments with President Bush addressing Congress in September of 2001, a few days after 9/11. And the applause has been shortened for time reasons.
And tonight, the United States of America makes the following demands on the Taliban. Deliver to United States authorities all the leaders of al-Qaeda who hide in your land. Release all foreign nationals, including American citizens you have unjustly imprisoned. protect foreign journalists, diplomats, and aid workers in your country. Close immediately and permanently every terrorist training camp in Afghanistan and hand over every terrorist and every person in their support structure to appropriate authorities. Give the United States full access to terrorist training camps so we can make sure they are no longer operating. These demands are not open to negotiation or discussion.
Steve Call, given the exhaustive research you've done now in this account of the 15 years of war in Afghanistan, what do those demands sound like to you now? Are they at all realistic?
Well, it's fascinating because it's the beginning of a thread in this history that really entangles the United States, which is, what is our attitude about the Taliban? So it's very interesting. I mean, if you listen to the president's words all these years later, so this is after the shock, after the fury of our experience of September 11th, just days after September 11th. You know, the Twin Towers are still smoldering when he gives that speech. And notice, though, he doesn't declare war on the Taliban. He's basically saying, you can avoid a war if you help us against al-Qaeda. Our real enemy is al-Qaeda. And embedded in those demands is a recognition that the Taliban didn't attack us on September 11th, right? There were no Afghans on those planes. It's not even clear the Taliban leadership knew about the 9/11 plot. So the Bush administration did not want to fight an unnecessary war against the Taliban because it did not regard the Taliban as necessarily international terrorists. If the Taliban had decided to turn over bin Laden in response to those demands and to cooperate in the other ways that President Bush listed, we might not have sought the overthrow of the Taliban government. And the Pakistani intelligence service was urging us not to get into a long war with the Taliban. And what really unfolds over the next 15 years in the Situation Room and other classified conference rooms where strategists return to the problem of the Afghan war is a continuous debate about whether we should be at war with the Taliban, whether they constitute enough of a threat to justify the huge sacrifices that we're making in Afghanistan, and if we are at war with them, how are we going to prevail? And you know, by the time you get to 2009, when the Afghan war has revived and is really falling into a more and more violent conflict, President Obama comes in and his team gets into the same classified conference rooms and debate the same subjects. And, you know, President Obama really doesn't want to fight a war against the Taliban. He doesn't think it's winnable on any acceptable timeline or at any acceptable cost. But at this point, the Pentagon is already at war with the Taliban, and it wants to try to finish the job. And so it becomes more and more entangled. And frankly, to this day, we really have not figured out where we're going against the Taliban. You know, we're fairly clear that international terrorist groups that attack in Europe or the United States, like al-Qaeda or the Islamic State, we have to suppress them. We have to attack them. We have to prevent them from attacking us. But the Taliban has always been a much harder problem.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the initial stages of that war. In part of your book called Losing the Peace, you write about new reporting on how and why the Bush administration failed to take advantage in those early years and achieve a victory in say 2002. Take us back to that time and to some of the key decisions that led to a failure to consolidate that military victory.
Yeah, so it's a very important period, because if you know, counterfactual history is a difficult thing, and I'm wary of trying to go back and say, well, what if we'd done it this way? But I think if you ask, could we have ever done it better in Afghanistan, then you're looking at these years, 2002 to 2005. And remember, the Taliban had been defeated by our lightning strike war in the fall of 2001. Those Taliban leaders who weren't killed in the war had fled into Pakistan. They were completely disorganized. Al-Qaeda had also suffered a lot of losses in Afghanistan, and its surviving leaders and operators had also left and gone into Pakistan. The whole world was united around supporting Afghanistan's revival. The Afghans themselves came home from many years of exile and hoped to rebuild their country with international support. They wrote a constitution. They adopted a constitution. They staged two successful elections for president and for parliament. And we failed to consolidate that achievement for three reasons. First, we didn't invest in reconstruction and security at anything like the levels that were required. Partly this was an ideological view of the Bush administration against nation building, but mostly it was that we were determined to go off to the next war in Iraq. Even by the summer of 2002, that war was already being planned, and the military commanders who had been sent to Afghanistan to keep the peace basically said to themselves, well, don't build anything permanent here because we're going off now to fight another war. The second reason was that we didn't learn the lessons of history, or we didn't apply the lessons of history. When you win a war against an enemy like the Taliban, you know, you can hold their leaders accountable, you can try war criminals, but you can't hold every foot soldier, every sergeant, every lieutenant who fought against you as a permanent enemy. In Germany, in Japan, we reconstructed those countries and stabilized them by developing pathways for reintegration and reconciliation after our victories. And in Afghanistan, we failed to do that. We treated every Taliban as a candidate for Guantanamo. In fact, we shipped many of them off to Guantanamo. And that just sowed seeds of bitterness in the Taliban and fueled their comeback.
If you just joined me, my guest today is Steve Call, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Ghost Wars. His latest book is Directorate S, The CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. It's a comprehensive book, widely lauded, a 15-year narrative opening on the eve of 9/11 up to pretty much the present day. Let's jump to back to President Obama coming onto this scene. I want to play a little clip of President Obama speaking about his new approach to Afghanistan in 2009. This is a little bit of that speech where he focuses on, as you do in this book, with on Pakistan and the relationship between Afghanistan and Pakistan. This is March 27th, 2009, President Obama.
The future of Afghanistan is inextricably linked to the future of its neighbor, Pakistan. In the nearly 8 years since 9/11, al-Qaeda and its extremist allies have moved across the border to the remote areas of the Pakistani frontier. This almost certainly includes al-Qaeda's leadership, Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri. They have used this mountainous terrain as a safe haven to hide, to train terrorists, to communicate with followers, to plot attacks, and to send fighters to support the insurgency in Afghanistan. For the American people, this border region has become the most dangerous place in the world.
So compare how Barack Obama entering the scene saw the war with what had transpired under President Bush. How much of a change was there here, or a change that was meant to be?
There wasn't that much of a change. I think by the second term of the Bush administration, the Bush cabinet had recognized that the war was getting worse, that they probably needed to turn their attention to it, and also that ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Service, was part of the problem, and that al-Qaeda had taken advantage of its refuge in Pakistan to plot serious attacks against the United States and its allies, and it was certainly rocking Pakistan as well. So what was so interesting about President Obama's remarks that you just played is it highlights a real dilemma that his administration wrestled with during his first year in office, which is they went back to these, you know, classified conference rooms that the Bush strategists had been in, and they debated what vital interest do we have in this war in Afghanistan that would justify sending tens of thousands of more troops, putting young men and women in harm's way. What are we trying to achieve here that matters so much? And they identified two vital interests. One, the president announced in those remarks, which is al-Qaeda. So al-Qaeda is a menace, a danger. It's trying to blow up airplanes. It's trying to bomb American subways. We've got to make sure that we destroy its leadership. And the second interest they identified was, which they don't talk about in public so much, was we've got to make sure Pakistan's nuclear weapons don't fall into the wrong hands. All right, well, let's pause and think about those two interests. Let's accept them as important to the United States. The problem was, in 2009, when Obama was sending troops to Afghanistan, both of those problems were actually not in Afghanistan. They were across the border in Pakistan. As the president said in that speech you just highlighted, the Al-Qaeda's leadership was across the border in Pakistan, but we were sending our troops to Afghanistan. Now, the cabinet making that decision were smart enough to recognize the contradiction. They rationalized their decision by saying, well, if Afghanistan falls apart, then Al-Qaeda will come back. But it's kind of an indirect reason to fight a war. And now the direct action that the Obama administration took against Al-Qaeda was through the drone war that the CIA ran, which President Obama escalated. And that was the one way they could really make a difference inside Pakistan. But there was a limit to how much they could really do, first because not all Al-Qaeda were living along the border where the drones operated, but secondly because Pakistan looked so unstable, it was suffering from massive waves of terrorism itself, that if the U.S. put too much pressure on the country over its support for the Taliban, for example, it might get the very nightmare scenario that we were trying to prevent, which is the loss of control over Pakistan's nuclear weapons, the collapse of the order in Pakistan. So it was a mess. And the war aims that we pursued were often entangled in these kinds of contradictions.
Mm-hmm. So talk more about overall the broad big picture of the Pakistani-U.S. relationship. It was once described as a strategic alliance. And that deteriorated, and you describe that in this book for a number of reasons. How did that begin, and what were the chief causes of a strategic alliance sort of deteriorating into mistrust?
Well, it's a central question of the history, and if you go back, I mean, it's a relationship that's blown hot and cold over the decades. We were partners during the Cold War, where we were united in opposition to the Soviet Union. Pakistan provided important help back in the day, bases from which we flew U-2 surveillance planes over the Soviet Union. Then we cooperated together against the Soviet occupation in Afghanistan. And, Pakistan, it was Pakistan that facilitated Nixon's opening to China, another ally of Pakistan. So we had this history of working together on important strategic matters. But when Pakistan acquired nuclear weapons in the 1980s and the Cold War ended, we sanctioned them. We essentially abandoned the relationship, put pressure on them, and Pakistan turned bitter about our unreliability. And so on 9/11, when we came back to Pakistan and said, you're either with us or against us, they decided to return to the relationship, but they had this bitterness and of recent experience and mistrust. So even though they did cooperate immediately after 2001 in the arrests of important al-Qaeda leaders who had fled to Pakistan, there was always a kind of mistrust that troubled the relationship. President Bush tried to build a trusting relationship with Pervez Musharraf, the Pakistan military leader, and he succeeded to some extent. But when the Pakistanis saw us turning away from Afghanistan to fight in Iraq, they decided that their interests required them to go back to their playbook, and there wasn't enough trust in the relationship for them to do that in a kind of transparent way. They did it secretly, dishonestly. And so eventually when the Obama administration came in and inherited this problem, they thought, well, maybe we should try to smother the Pakistanis in love again. You know, let's try to revive a true strategic partnership. And they spent a year or two, negotiating at the highest levels with the Pakistanis. What would it take for us to really be partners? What would it take for you to abandon the Taliban and stop supporting groups that are killing our troops in Afghanistan? And they exchanged some secret papers about what the Pakistanis would really want. And, the Pakistanis' list of requests was quite formidable. They wanted help against India. They wanted help with their water problems, energy problems, and lots of things the Americans weren't sure they could deliver. But before they could even get to the end of that negotiation, we got to 2011, and we find Osama bin Laden hiding in Pakistan, a mile from the Pakistani military academy, and we go in and kill him without telling the Pakistanis what we're doing because we don't trust him enough. And the relationship basically collapsed during that year and hasn't really recovered.
Talk a little bit more about that story of how bin Laden's killing in early May of 2011 unfolded from the perspective of the Pakistani army and the intelligence services of Pakistan.
Yeah, so it was really a spy versus spy year that started out a few months before the raid on Badabad, when a CIA operative in Pakistan on the streets of Lahore, who was driving around by himself in a Honda, he was scouting, you know, routes on the streets where CIA agents might be driven. And he saw some guys behind him with guns, and he thought he was about to be robbed. And so he pulled out his own pistol and shot dead two Pakistanis on the streets of Lahore and then tried to get away. And he was arrested and imprisoned. And the CIA denied that he was one of theirs for weeks, infuriating the Pakistanis because they knew they found all of his materials, including his bank account that listed him as a CIA guy. And so mistrust developed. But one reason why the Americans couldn't tell the Pakistanis, were afraid to tell the Pakistanis what was going on, was because they were secretly planning for this raid on Abbottabad. They were worried that if the raid took place while this CIA guy was in Pakistani prison, that he'd be killed. And so they negotiated to get him out. And the Pakistani intelligence services were just more and more furious about the relationship. And then you get to May, and the Pakistani army chief is at home that night, up late in his study, and he gets a call, and the news is that somebody's flying helicopters here without authorization. The Pakistani army chief initially thinks it must be the Indians attacking our nuclear facilities. Eventually, someone calls him back and says, no, it looks to have been the Americans, and they seem to have killed Osama bin Laden and left. And they go through a series of discussions about whether they should try to shoot down the American helicopters. Pakistani army chief thinks, well, you know, the planes we would use to shoot them down were supplied to us by the United States, so they know how to disable them. This is not going to work. Eventually, he gets on the phone with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Mike Mullen, Admiral Mike Mullen, and he says, congratulations, this is good for you, but it's going to be very bad for us, because they were essentially humiliated in front of their own people for failing to stop the Americans. The Americans hadn't involved them in the raid. And there were lots of questions inside Pakistan immediately. Either you were complicit in Osama bin Laden's hiding in this place, or you were incompetent because you didn't know he was there. Which is it? And they ended up getting hauled in front of Parliament, and a whole crisis evolved after that.
My conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Steve Call continues in just a moment. His latest book, Directorate S, examines the CIA's role in America's secret wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Now back to my conversation with Steve Call. Call won the Pulitzer Prize in 2005 for his book, Ghost Wars. His latest book is called Directorate S, the CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. It offers a 15-year narrative, which opens on the eve of September 11, 2001. At this point in my conversation with Call, I asked him to talk about a chapter in his book titled Homicide Division. It has to do with a wave of murders of American soldiers and officers in 2012 by supposed Afghan army and police allies, and the secret investigation by a former CIA officer named Mark Sageman.
Yes, it was a real crisis in the war because our effort to get out of the main effort in Afghanistan relied on partnering with Afghan army and police to hand the war off to them in 2012 as we reduced our own presence. And then this wave of insider murders, insider killings, The Army referred to them sometimes as green-on-blue killings, meaning friendly Afghan forces turning on Western officers in the middle of a firefight or during a soccer game and just shooting as many people dead as they could. The crisis was so bad that by 2012, these murders constituted a quarter, 25% of NATO's fatalities in the war. And it threatened to break up the coalition because European governments started to pull out, saying, we're not going to put up with this if we're getting shot by our own allies. So they sent this guy, Mark Sageman, in as a kind of homicide detective to figure out whether there was what was causing this and whether it could be prevented. And there was a debate inside the command about whether this was a problem of Taliban infiltration, like deliberate espionage operations, or whether this was a problem of cultural incompatibility, a misunderstanding. And so the story of Homicide Division is how this character, Mark Sageman, is a very interesting character. He used a whole series of investigative techniques to figure out case by case what was going on. And what he found was that, first of all, there are a lot of different reasons why these Afghans were turning on their American or European counterparts and shooting them. But the main reason was that they weren't Taliban infiltrators in the sense that they hadn't been sent by the Taliban to do this violence. But they basically changed their minds about the war while they were on the American side, inside American bases. And then they would call the Taliban, or the Taliban would call them. And you know, the Taliban weren't sure whether these guys were for real. Like, maybe they're spies who are pretending to defect to the Taliban. And so they would tell them, well, if you want to join the Taliban, just kill as many people as you can and come over here, and that will prove that you really are on our side. And so that's what would typically happen. These guys would shoot up a base and then leave and join the Taliban. So they were really side switchers. And what the prevention finding was that, you know, in counterespionage, when you're trying to detect traitors in your own midst, there are techniques for monitoring people so that you can pick up signs that they're potentially going to defect. And in this case, nobody was listening to the phone calls or the chatter. And if they had been, they would have noticed that these people were calling the Taliban, and they would have intervened before they could act. And so that was one of the prevention measures that came out of this.
Yeah, but that wave of murders, inside murders, had dramatic repercussions for the international coalition, didn't it?
Yeah, the French pulled out explicitly because of the murders. The Australians reduced their presence. Other European governments said, you know, look, the European public was completely weary of this war. There was no politics in Europe to carry it on. But this provided a very easy reason for those governments to say, we've overstayed our welcome. It's time to come home.
Steve Call is my guest, director at S. His latest book, The CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. You talked about the deterioration of the one strategic alliance between Pakistan and the U.S. Zoom in a little bit to talk about the relationship, and the focus of your book is on sort of the intelligence agencies, the CIA, and then Pakistan's ISI. What about that relationship over this period of time? How did they view each other? How did that change? How did they operate in the same space?
Well, it was a kind of spy versus spy story that started out with kind of tentative, wary trust and cooperation after 2001. The CIA came in and smothered the ISI with a lot of money, helped them renovate their headquarters in downtown Islamabad, tried to spend as much time inside the ISI as they could, both to work on operations together, but also to get to meet people. And maybe one of the reasons the CIA wanted to stay so close to ISI was they figured that if anybody in Pakistan knew where Osama bin Laden was, it was probably an ISI officer, so maybe they could flip one of those, recruit one as a agent of the United States. So they wanted relationships. The ISI knew, of course, that the Americans were inclined to try to recruit their own officers, so they tried to restrict the relationship, keep it solely on a professional basis. You're not allowed to have dinner with those guys. You can't go out to the club and have a coffee or a scotch after work. But by and large, the cooperation, at least against non-Pakistani, non-Afghan terrorist suspects, you know, Arab, Chechen, Uzbeks, that the Pakistanis didn't want in their country either, it continued for a few years. But then gradually the mistrust grew and grew, primarily because the Americans came to understand that their ISI friends were now back in action supporting the Taliban, and that this support was costing American soldiers their lives across the border in Afghanistan. And so the tensions rose. There would still, you know, there you'd go through these intervals where ISI would just refuse to see their CIA counterparts, but then they would relent and there would be one meeting to have some cooperative action. Finally, by the time you get to 2011, they really almost feel like they're at war with one another. It's more like Moscow in the in the Cold War, spy versus spy, total mistrust. There's a CIA station chief who was serving in Pakistan at the time of the bin Laden raid, who had to go home after his tour because he had, you know, a mysterious and very severe illness, stomach illness. And, you know, there was a lot of speculation on his part and at CIA that maybe he had been poisoned by ISI. And you know, they couldn't prove it, but it was the kind of attitude that reflected, you know, how hardened and estranged the two services had become.
Steve Call, in your book, you also include some perspectives from some of the U.S. troops fighting and also journal entries. Here's one excerpt from the journal entry you include of Lieutenant Timothy J. Hopper. This is from 2010. The end of that entry, it's pretty crazy. Coming back from counter IED trainer, we saw some Afghans outside the wire and they flicked us off or shook their fists at us. Some hearts and minds campaign, huh? And tell us about including some of these journal entries and what you're trying to do there in the writing, in including those in this account.
Thank you for reading that. I mean, that the lieutenant was really helpful to the book, and he shared his journals with me. And my purpose was, you know, a lot of the narrative of the kind of Pentagon Papers history of this war, secret decision-making at the highest levels in Washington or in Pakistan or Afghanistan, it necessarily involves, you know, the decision-makers and the factors that influence their choices in the war, whether to escalate or to fight a counterinsurgency campaign in southern Afghanistan, for example. And I wanted to include the consequences of those decisions at a human level on the ground for the American soldiers who were dispatched to fight the counterinsurgency war at the peak of our escalation, 2010-2011, when we had ultimately 100,000-plus Americans in Afghanistan fighting the Taliban. So I chose this particular campaign to the west of Kandahar in very difficult terrain, in irrigated zone known as the Green Zone, and with 10-foot-tall marijuana plants and thick grape orchards with thick walls 10 feet tall in some cases that were worse than fighting in the hedgerows of Normandy after the invasion of Normandy in the Second World War. And we had all these young men and women who were, you know, in some cases not even trained for this kind of ground combat, and we sent them in to clear out this zone and paid a huge price in lost lives and limbs. The casualty rates in some of these task forces that fought alongside Lieutenant Hopper were just staggering. The Marines in Helmand also took very heavy losses, but this particular campaign west of Kandahar is very costly. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the themes in his story is that his unit, the 1/320th, was an artillery unit that had been converted to an infantry fight. And, you know, artillery soldiers are trained to fight from a distance with big guns, and, you know, it's kind of an engineering war. And they really had no experience of this, and so they some of the soldiers were just absolutely gobsmacked at what they were being asked to do, and basically every 100 yards you'd step on an IED that would blow up and someone would either lose their life or lose their arms or legs. And it was very, very challenging. But anyway, Lieutenant Hopper's journal gives you the flavor of what that experience was like on the ground, and then I right in between the journal entries, a kind of account of the campaign. He survived and is still in the Army today.
Mm-hmm. I'm struck by what you just said and many things you've said during this conversation, how you could perhaps pull out excerpts of what you're saying, and we would not know necessarily whether you're talking about Afghanistan or Vietnam Hopper's words, some hearts and minds campaign, huh? Of course, that's taken directly from the Vietnam conflict. To what degree do you think we repeated the mistakes, the assumptions of Vietnam in Afghanistan?
To a discouraging degree. I watched, probably like some of your listeners, the Ken Burns documentary last fall about Vietnam, and this was after I had finished, you know, the 5-10 years of work I'd done on Directorate S, and I was really struck by the repetitions of failure. And the character of our mistakes is similar in some respects. You know, trying to hand off the war because you don't really see an end in sight, but you don't want a dishonorable abandonment of the war. The kind of hubristic assumptions around hearts and minds and counterinsurgency doctrine, and then the failure to achieve goals despite high confidence that you can win the war that way, and the very specific kind of on-the-ground hearts and minds failures, and the kind of absurdity, really, of thinking that you're going to win over Afghan loyalty at the point of a gun, the way we were fighting in some parts of southern Afghanistan, especially where in the area where Tim Hopper was. So, yeah, all of that's there. There's a very interesting set of scenes early in the Obama administration. The president appointed Richard Holbrooke as his principal envoy to the diplomat to try to negotiate some exit from the war. And Holbrooke, as a young Foreign Service officer, had served in Vietnam in the Mekong Delta. And as President Obama thought about escalating the troop levels in Afghanistan, Holbrooke and Vice President Joe Biden were among those who cautioned him, saying, you know, let's not repeat that cycle. And Holbrooke in particular would say, you know, I was there. I saw this happen once before in the Johnson administration. And President Obama was really irritated by those comparisons. You know, he said, this is not Vietnam, and I don't want to hear about Vietnam. And I was talking to Holbrooke during this period, and I went back to some of the interview notes, and he came out of one session at the White House, and he was chagrined that he had alienated the president. He needed the president's support. And he said, you know, I know that I anger them by talking about Vietnam, but they shouldn't be so afraid of history. Mm. And I think he was right about that.
A few more minutes talking with our guest today, Steve Call. Directorate S is his latest work, The CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan, a narrative, 15 years of narrative, which opens on the eve of 9/11 up to pretty much the present. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University, also staff writer for The New Yorker. I wanted to bring us up, have you comment on the present day. Donald Trump has been president in office for more than a year. Let's hear a little bit about his reset. We heard from George W. Bush, we heard from President Obama about his then new strategy in March of 2009. Let's go to August of 2017, a few words from President Trump, and have you comment about his approach after that.
A core pillar of our new strategy is a shift from a time-based approach to one based on conditions. I've said it many times, how counterproductive it is for the United States to announce in advance the dates we intend to begin or end military options. We will not talk about numbers of troops or our plans for further military activities. Conditions on the ground, not arbitrary timetables, will guide our strategy from now on.
Okay, so Steve, what can you tell us about Donald Trump's strategy in Afghanistan, how it differs from George W. Bush and Barack Obama?
I think overall there's more continuity than change in the strategy. There are some departures. That's probably the most important one is not that one that he highlighted in those remarks, but the pressure that they put on Pakistan by suspending aid to the country. That's certainly a step that the Obama administration considered but was hesitant to take because of the fear that it would alienate Pakistan further and perhaps lead to an escalation in the war or the further destabilization of Pakistan. You know, this talk about timelines is really kind of fighting the last argument in the Situation Room, with the generals being frustrated with President Obama's decision, which he announced in December 2009, when he escalated the number of American troops in Afghanistan substantially toward a peak of 100,000 plus, he also announced as he was sending troops in when they would start going out. And he said in the summer of 2011, they'll start to come home. Now, it was a strange decision to say we're going in and we're going out in a war. And the generals were upset about it then, and they're still upset about it. But by the end of the Obama administration, in fact, there was no timeline strategy. The Obama administration had gone into an indefinite posture of support for the Afghan military, yes, conditions-based, and hoping to reduce the amount of troops and money that we were expending in this effort. The Obama administration also went back to a direct war against the Islamic State. So today we're actually fighting two wars in Afghanistan. We're fighting one against the Islamic State in direct combat with them from the air mostly, but some special forces. And then we're also fighting an advise and assist war, as it's called, to help the Afghan forces defeat the Taliban. That war is a stalemate and has been for a decade.
Mm-hmm. So what's your outlook now? Do we have various paths in front of us, or are we on some kind of predetermined path, does it seem to you, after tracing this narrative a decade and a half long?
Well, I guess I'm sorry to say, I think we continue to do the same things and expect different results. We're prioritizing military action. The president hopes that by showing resolve and a determination to stay forever, that this will change the balance in the war. But the balance in the war didn't shift even when we had 150,000 of the world's best international combat troops fighting the Taliban. We haven't solved the problem of the Taliban sanctuary in Pakistan. I don't think suspending aid to Pakistan is going to solve that problem. And we haven't come up with a political or diplomatic strategy to complement military action, even though all of our military commanders will acknowledge that a war like this doesn't end on the battlefield. It ends with political negotiation. So I suspect that when the next president, whether it's President Trump being re-inaugurated or a new president coming in January 2021, I think we're still going to be at this war.
For this book, you and others connected with this research did over 550 interviews. Who stands out in this very long, comprehensive narrative? Who stands out in your mind as heroes in this story? Do any leap out?
Well, the truth tellers always attract me as a journalist. There was an advisor to Richard Holbrooke named Barnett Rubin, who's probably the leading academic expert on Afghanistan in the United States. He's based at New York University, but he's written about the country for many years and speaks some of its language. And, you know, he was someone who came into the Obama administration and worked very hard across, you know, 6, 7, 8 years, first with Holbrooke and then with others. And he was always willing to speak up and say what was unpopular in the Situation Room. You know, for example, this war is not winnable militarily, or, you know, maybe it makes sense to talk to the Taliban. Maybe the Taliban are not determined to carry out international terrorism. And, you know, he was valued because he knew so much, and he could talk to the Taliban himself or to ex-Taliban and give kind of his own intelligence about the war. It's rare in the U.S. system when you're a journalist trying to excavate these kinds of stories and characters. It's rare to have someone who's willing to say whatever he thinks or she thinks. You know, mostly people are worried about their next job or what the conventional wisdom is. And there's too much of that in this history, you know, too much kind of groupthink about the war. So it's always refreshing to have a character walk on stage who's willing to just say whatever is on his mind.
Quickly, before we say goodbye, I wonder, have you had some interesting reaction here? So many U.S. Servicemen and women served in Afghanistan, perhaps from troops on the ground. You quote their journal entries in this work as well.
There's been a lot of, the book's been out for 2 weeks, so I've only had initial sets of reactions, but it's been very gratifying. One of my purposes was to provide a record for American soldiers and others who volunteered to serve in Afghanistan. Hundreds of thousands of Americans touched ground in Afghanistan, even as aid workers and diplomats, as well as soldiers. And I think many of them came home wondering, you know, was it worthwhile? A lot of them know the country well from their experiences, but they still maybe are puzzled by how did we get from there to here? So that was a purpose of the book. And also equally for Afghans and Pakistanis, because they've suffered terrible violence as a result of this long war, and I think are puzzled as to how what was the United States thinking? What was it trying to do? What was our government thinking? How did we end up here? So that was my motivation to try to get something that was reliable and thorough and readable for all those groups.
Okay, Steve Call, it's been a real pleasure spending the hour with you. Thank you so much for your time. Steve Call is author of his latest book, Directorate S, The CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Steve Call, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.